This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.
Coming up on the Free For All, Dennis Berman, financial editor of the Wall Street Journal. We'll talk a little bit about that fancy sounding job, but also college hoop, because Dennis is from Kentucky. He's a big Louisville fan. Louisville's not in the tournament. What's Dennis going to do? Next, Free For All.
You're listening to Free For All from the Wall Street Journal. Now, here's Jason Gay.
Hey, this is Jason Gay, and you are listening to the Free For All. My very loyal colleague, Jim Cherusmi, is out of the podcast today because he sent me this very cryptic note saying, I'm awaiting a very important phone call. Now, I don't know what that could be. Jim could be on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and he might be the person who is the phone-a-friend person. He might be awaiting some sort of incredible call about some sort of contest sweepstakes. Or it could be very serious. It could be, you know, news from a doctor. We don't know. We'll find out in our next podcast. But joining me today, very important guest, a very important person here at the Wall Street Journal, Dennis Berman, who is the financial editor of the WSJ. Dennis, thanks for being here.
Good afternoon.
I'm very happy to have you here for two reasons. One is I want to know a little bit about what you do, what your job is here at the Wall Street Journal, because it's an important job. You know, you're a modest guy. You're not looking to puff yourself up. But let's face it, you know, you run the Wall Street part of the Wall Street Journal, as the bio says. It's an important thing. And then the second thing is, you're a guy from Kentucky, Louisville, Kentucky, and
yeah.
So you know a little bit about college basketball. You have thoughts. You have opinions.
Yes.
And we are
feelings.
We are feelings, especially.
More disturbingly, especially, I have feelings,
especially here. As we are about to begin a Louisville-free March Madness.
Well put.
But let's get to what you do.
Where you came from.
Okay, so you're from Kentucky.
Yes.
You get into journalism how?
I got into journalism writing a handwritten note to the editor of American Heritage Magazine saying I was fascinated by history and I would love to work as an intern at his magazine.
I have to imagine your penmanship was good if this
was a hand. My penmanship is terrible.
It is. Okay.
But presumably my thoughts were sincere and direct. And he said yes. I knew no one in journalism.
Okay.
I knew I had no great network or any of those things that people talk about today. It was just an interest, right?
Yeah.
And I wrote a note to this fellow named Richard Snow, who I hope he still has a great mustache. He's a wonderful author, a wonderful writer, and a great mustachioed editor. American Heritage.
We don't have as many of those anymore.
No. They're dwindling in number. But he was a special species of...
I'm talking about the mustachioed editor. We still have great editors. We just don't have the mustaches, what we used to have in newsrooms.
Special species of just interesting and inspirational person. And he said, yes, we'd love to have you. And so I got this internship one summer in New York. And I was a fact checker, fact checking these historical facts, which is serious business.
Yeah.
Because if you screw up the P-51 Thunderbolt S versus the P-51 whatever, you will get hateful messages from readers. So that was really the start.
And so it was a summer in New York as this intern, or did it extend from beyond there?
Summer in New York, and then I don't know why people would be interested in this, but you're asking, so I'm telling.
How old were you?
How old was I? 19.
Okay. So 19 years. Where'd you live?
I lived at this dorm at NYU.
Now, did you go completely bananas the whole summer, or were you just disciplined and, you know, a good fact checker?
No, it was fact checker by night and...
by day.
Fact checker. Fact checker by day and voracious Gothamite by night. It was a lot of fun. It was still, there was still like the last vestiges of menace were left in New York City. So I remember going up to a place on 99th Street and being so scared. So like the place I went to now is probably a $4 million condo.
Yes, of course.
But I remember going to that place and feeling like 99th Street. I just don't know about that one. So it was a wonderful summer, wonderful experience. They took a chance on me. And from there, I got an internship at Time Inc., working at Money Magazine.
They still have the bar cart when you were there at Time Inc.?
No, but it was the vestiges of the old days. It was It
so
was
what
really,
kind of stuff?
It was really right on the cusp of when the internet was taking off, like 95, 96. Certainly screwed up the business model of Time Inc. And it was...
Did you ever expense a car out to the Hamptons or anything like that?
I never did that, but they paid well. It was just... People had the editors there. They did have houses in the Hamptons. Yeah. Like, it was just a different time and a different economic state for the industry.
You were Lions of New York.
They were. And I was a lowly fact checker again, writing articles about the money college survey or something. But all great experience. It was really kind of a wonderful last window into the old age.
And then from there...
From there, I went to Business Week. Okay. Business Week Online. It was a group of five people putting material up on America Online.
Okay.
And I was
so
running.
I had to have an AOL account to read this.
You had to have an AOL. They paid, AOL paid Business Week for the right to their content.
Was this post-merger with Time Warner, the whole deal when, Case and
This was pre-merger.
Turner, it was pre-merger. Okay.
Pre-merger.
Okay.
And there were... five of us, and I started writing stories, and had another great editor there. Anyhow, I think, despite my protestations, this is not that interesting. I think I'm trying to draw conclusions for you.
You
I think,
get to the journal how?
There is this job covering telecommunications equipment open. The door is closing. They're going to stop hiring soon. I meet this woman named Lori Hayes, who went on to great things at the Journal and later at Bloomberg, and she says, well, why don't you come here?
Yeah.
And I did. So I started covering telecom equipment. Exciting topic. Again, now that I think about it, there are great revelations in my story in that I appear to be leaving each era just at the right time.
You're kind of like the guy hopping from ice flow to ice flow, right?
Totally,
as it's
right?
disappearing into the... See,
that's a good point because right when I get there in 2001, the telecom equipment business, once worth billions and billions of dollars, is in free fall. Yes. And the first story I write for the Journal is about an SEC a scoop, mind you. I gotta preface that a scoop about the SEC investigating Lucent Technologies for accounting misdeeds.
Gotcha, Lucent.
Do you remember that company?
Of course I do. They had the circle, the painted circle
beautiful,
logo. Yeah.
Beautiful logo.
Yeah, one of the great logos.
Why don't they do logos like that anymore?
They don't have focus groups like they used to, Dennis. it clearly seemed focus group. But, okay, so big scoop rises your stature probably a little bit in the newsroom. Who's this guy? Who's this ex-fact checker from Time Inc. wandering around with the big scoop? Things have proceeded well since then. You are part of a Pulitzer.
Yeah.
For the Journal, where do you keep the Pulitzer in the house?
I have to tell you, I lost it.
For real.
It was like a certificate.
Okay.
I got it framed at one point.
It's not a trophy like the Oscar.
No.
People think it's,
it wasn't like my thing. It was a group of people who won it. But there was one of my stories that worked for a long, long time on. It was a pretty darn good story, actually, now that I look back on it like every 5 years or something. But I lost it.
In a move? Rash throwing out or something
that? I don't know where it is.
Can you contact Columbia and ask for a reproduction? Is there anything we can do?
That's a good idea.
We can also go down with a hammer right now and rip it right off the wall, like down where there's a Journal Hall of Fame. We can pry it off with a hammer and a screwdriver.
It's not a bad idea. Maybe I'll just call Columbia and ask for a facsimile.
And so now you are the financial editor of the Wall Street Journal. And when I think of somebody who's the financial editor of the Wall Street Journal, I think, this is the marquee. This is... manager of the Yankees, you are sort of at the belly of the beast. This is the sort of heartbeat of what this paper has traditionally been and always be. How many people work with you?
Depends how you count. It's roughly a few hundred.
Yeah. And, are you a benevolent boss? Are you, a screamer? Are you, how do you motivate people? We're all getting into college basketball.
I know, this is turning into a different type of session. I think about that a lot as a manager.
Yeah.
How does one see oneself? Can we see ourselves?
Or what did you respond to?
We cannot see ourselves.
Yeah.
We really can't. Yeah. And I try to do the best job I can, but knowing that... self-awareness is fleeting, but it's also essential, I think, to people performing well in this profession and, frankly, any profession. How does one recognize what one's good at or bad at, how the emotions play into it? It's interesting. At a certain level, skill matters, but it's really something a little bit more, I think, that really takes someone to a higher level of performance.
Have you drawn on any of the good editors that you had in the past, people who you felt were very essential to your journalistic growth?
Well, sure. I mean, there's a whole rash of them. I mean, that's one thing I love about the Journal is that it's an oral tradition. There's not like a handbook they give you.
Right.
And even if they did, it would be useless and out of date immediately.
Right.
But to be in a place that that was there before you and will be there after you and that has these ideals and values, that to me is the cool part about working here. It's like it's bigger than any one of us by far.
The nature of what your department does, you know, in degrees everyone has this responsibility in any kind of newspaper environment now, but the sort of balance between the up to the nanosecond coverage that is essential for readers of the newspaper versus, you know, being able to sort of pull the lens back and look at news that's happening, whether it's on Wall Street or elsewhere, and give that kind of analytics that you want to bring. How do you balance those two ambitions, especially in a digital era?
Well, it's really hard. But it's not impossible by any stretch. It's very interesting to see that some of the reporters who were great at the small stuff are actually quite good at the big stuff too. You know, I have a saying that if you want to write the big stories, you have to write the small stories.
Sure.
And I learned that writing like 1,000-word quarterly earnings updates on Lucent Technologies.
Yeah.
You just got to know your stuff.
Yeah.
And so there's this idea that there can be this class of Brahmin-like seers and reporters who can do the big stories.
Yeah.
there probably are, and there are even at a place like the Journal. But I think for the most part, if you want to do the big stories, you got to really dig in. And so there's a wonderful reporter. I'll name her. If she's listening, then I hope she'll say, "Why did you mention me?" Nicole Friedman, who covers the ins and outs of the oil markets, and you know when the price of crude, WTI crude, moves 50 cents, she's writing something.
On it. Yeah.
But the closeness to the market and to her topic has given her a set of tools for writing larger stories that has really served her well. So I'm a little bit skeptical of the, you know, top down big gun. I'm a little more in favor of the small arms fire kind of person.
Sure. The what do you call it? SEAL Team 6 approach.
SEAL Team 6.
Yeah. You probably get this asked this once in a while, but in terms of young journalists, people you see coming in to whether it's the Journal or elsewhere, people you encounter out in your professional life, you know, it's a much different environment than when you and I entered this world, where it was almost exclusively a print product, or was exclusively a print product. You know, what do you make of? I mean, it's hard to generalize, of course. Everyone's a little bit different. But, you know, these millennials that are out there, in our newsroom, they have different kinds of skill sets and aptitudes and worldviews. What do you make of them so far?
I'm a little bit of a hard ass, I think. I don't know what the right word is. But
you believe in sort of earning your stripes and sort of working through
just
the
do the work. Right. So when I started, back to that musty library at American Heritage, wonderful library, full of beautiful stuff. Like the magazine is no longer exists, but it was incredible. You get a red pencil, and they'd print out these stories like in large type, and you'd have to put a mark over every letter in every word to make sure like the was spelled correct.
Yes. I know exactly what you're talking about.
I mean, it's absurd.
Yeah.
But it instilled kind of a discipline and early exposure that helped me. And to that,
there was no such thing as instant gratification.
No, and I don't think, it's, novel or difficult to say, do the work.
Yeah.
Earn your stripes and show me what you got. Like, I don't know why somehow the internet changes that. How does the internet change that?
Well, I think there's been this assumption that somehow, you know, someone who's younger might have a better aptitude for it and be able, more agile in terms of learning it and developing
but
for
aptitude
it.
Aptitude for what? The internet is just a medium. What you put on it is still the same skills and experience.
Listen, we're speaking the same language. I agree with you, Dennis. We're going to come right back with Dennis Berman, financial editor, Wall Street Journal. In one moment, we're going to talk some basketball here on the Free For All.
I'm Veronica Dagger. Do you want to know how the rich invest, spend, and protect their money? Then listen to the Watching Your Wealth podcast. For more information, check us out at wsj.com/podcasts and find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and now Spotify.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. Now, back to the show.
All right, we're done with the Inquisition of Dennis. If you have any more questions for him, email them to me.
Who is that
guy? I'll go directly to him. Let's talk a little basketball. Now, I don't want to... Let's get right to the hard stuff. You got a basketball team, which you're rather fond of, where you grew up, Louisville. Not in the tournament this year. Self-sacrificed themselves on the verge of, you know, perhaps losing their ability to go, but they were certainly qualified to go to the tournament. What do you think? Make of the mess that's happened down there with your Cardinals.
Well, I don't know whether it's old age or something else, Jason, but I've had sort of a set of realizations about the corruption, the absurdity, the silliness at the heart of the game. And it's taken a while, many years, perhaps decades, for me to come to the final sort of spot where, wait, my team is no better than any other team. They're all crooked. It's all a terrible game.
Yeah.
And I love it. I'm a fan. I was a ball boy when the Cardinals won the championship in 1986. Like, I was there in the 80s when this was peak Louisville basketball.
Denny Crum, Never Nervous Purvis.
Oh, I mean, I was there. I was there.
What was Never Nervous like?
He was, I mean, see, it's interesting. Like, back then it was all boys, all ball boys.
Yeah.
And I was a ball boy for, like, many games. Like, now they try to, like, I think, piece it out so everyone gets a favor, so to speak. But
and were you scared of Denny, or were you not scared of Denny?
I was scared of Denny. I'll tell you why I was scared of Denny. I went to basketball camp. I mean, I was really good for my neighborhood, but not much beyond the neighborhood. Yeah. and he said something that stuck with me. I'll share this with the young aspiring journalists.
Yeah.
I'll never forget this. He said, gathered us all around, and he said, you know, you're probably a pretty good player. You know, you're probably good in your school, maybe good in your neighborhood. But however good you think you are, there's someone better out there.
Yeah.
And that stuck with me. And so I always think about that.
Yeah, Denny Crum School of Journalism.
Denny Crum School of Life. However good you think you are, there's always someone better. And just try to be cognizant of that.
So you
Anyhow,
bleed Cardinal red is what you're saying.
I do. But I also am someone who I hope is paid to see the world for what it is and have that impulse in me. And what I see out of the program is kind of this hum of corruption. Whoever's who to blame about the, and we're talking, of course, about a stripper and sex scandal and money paid to recruit. Not money paid for sex for recruits. Louisville's any better than anyone else? Like, the answer is no.
I don't know if you know this, Dennis, but there's another basketball school in Kentucky down the road a little bit. Now, as a Cardinal fan, did you look down at UK and sort of think, well, the stuff, the nonsense that has gone on there, that does not happen.
I mean, that's what I think makes it so painful for Louisville fans is that if you said, okay, stop today, Calipari and Patino, who's going to get in trouble first?
Yeah.
We would all say
Calipari.
Calipari.
Of course.
I mean, Drake is hanging out in warm-ups.
Jay-Z's in the locker room.
Jay-Z's in the locker room. Right. They've got billboards of Anthony Davis and like on top of Las Vegas. It's like, it's so disgusting. It's so sleazy. Calipari is the worst. And if Kentucky fan, if he were the coach of Louisville, Kentucky fans would say the same.
Now, there is, you know, there's been some cross-pollination here, of course, though, because Pitino, of course, was the coach of Kentucky before coming to Louisville. And do you think, you know, in a weird way, what's happening now is the byproduct of that, that they didn't go out and get a pure Louisville guy?
Oh, no, I don't think that's relevant. I do think the game has gotten there's just so much money. People have been saying this forever. Like, I feel like I'm Sonny Vaccaro. Like, oh, the game is so corrupt.
Well, they do this weird thing now that, and in some ways I admire how Calipari at least sort of seems to be somewhat on the level, saying like, look, this is the way the world is right now. I don't like one and done. It's lame. It's not a great experience for me or for the players, but this is the environment we've been handed. We're going to do the best with it. Now, Pitino has taken a different stance, saying that we're not that kind of team. We don't do the one and dones like Kentucky. We are going to try to, you know, manage this team and put this team together in a manner that's different than what the prevailing thought is in college basketball. And they've done nicely with it.
Winning the championship in 2013.
That's right.
Which was an incredible experience as a
fan. That's right.
I do think, I have two observations on that. One, if you gave Pitino Calipari's players, you'd have, I think, much better results.
Really?
If you were to use a Wall Street analogy, sort of risk weight or weight based on the talent available to him, to each coach, Pitino's a far better coach.
Right.
The fact that the Kentucky team last, didn't they fall to who?
They lost the other day to...
No, last year they lost to... This
the
is a setup for you!
I can't believe I blew this up. They lost to the University of Wisconsin Badgers in a dramatic rout. Well, it wasn't even a rout, but I took it.
It was a wonderful game.
Great game.
The fact that...
Undefeated.
They couldn't get that team, or teams with DeMarcus Cousins and John Wall
all
the way to the championship.
Right. They underachieved.
They underachieved, believe it or not. Yeah. And Pitino has no doubt overachieved.
Yeah.
But it does make it all a little more uncomfortable when the Pitino way is revealed, at least first of the two, I hope. At least first of the two to have been... at least tolerant of a person who brought in strippers and money into the college basketball dorm.
Now, when you have this happen to your beloved Cardinals, are you just going to tune out of March Madness altogether, or will you watch a little bit?
Well, this year's been interesting. I didn't watch as many Louisville games. It did create, as I wrote in the column today, in the journal, it did create kind of this emotional distance that was almost like a relief.
Yeah.
You know, been a fan of your whole life and like, oh, you could kind of
be. It's good to take a breather.
It's good to take a breather. Yeah. So I'll probably watch the tournament. The best part of the tournament is really like the first 4 days.
Yeah, sure.
And you got people turning on the TV at work and so on. That's what I love. I'll probably watch some of it, but obviously it doesn't have the same meaning as it did for so many years.
Now, when you wander around the financial desk and you see someone has the little, you know, corner screen up in there, is that cool by you, at least for this part of the year?
That's okay. That's why I love the tournament, Jason, is because it's truly the only national sporting event in America. And everyone has a connection to a team.
Yeah.
Everyone... went to a school, everyone is nearby a school, and that's what makes it a wonderful experience. Despite its tainted and overwrought amount of commercials created by CBS.
You're not a big fan of the One Shining Moment?
I do love One Shining Moment.
Okay.
But isn't it amazing just the amount of commercials you have to watch?
No, it's extraordinary. And the last 2 minutes of the game takes 45 minutes.
Oh, it's painful. Really gotten worse. So.
Not to put you on the spot, but give me a pick.
Well, I'm going with Virginia.
Okay.
But I've got to put an asterisk by that choice.
Okay.
Because I haven't seen a lot of college basketball this year.
Yeah.
And Virginia thumped Louisville twice. I saw both those games. Yeah. So in my mind, that means, hey, let's pick Virginia.
Yeah.
But I obviously, it's not a stretch to say it's really open this year. Who's your pick?
My pick, of, I mean, it's the University of Wisconsin Badgers.
Come
who,
on.
Of course, started the season, you know, 1-4 in the Big Ten and rolled off, you know, 11 out of 12 to finish second in the Big Ten. I'm not letting that, you know, route from Nebraska in the first round of the Big Ten tournament dissuade me. I got us rolling over Pittsburgh, Xavier, and then, you know, it's off to the races for the
Badgers. So you used the word us.
Yeah, I'm a columnist, man. You know, like, there's no pretending. You know, I'm Badger all the way.
How do you deal? Wisconsin had its own scandal this year.
Which one are you referring to? The Bo Ryan scandal?
The Bo Ryan.
Yeah, it's hardly a scandal. It's almost quaint. It sounds like a Frank Capra movie. You know, it's like he has someone who he's, you know, friendly with, and there was an investigation of whether or not he unfairly took advantage of university resources or something like that.
Yeah,
fully cleared, Dennis.
Someone he's friendly with. But isn't it all the more an issue for Bo Ryan, given that he always projected the image of someone who was literally above the fray?
You know, maybe. I don't think he was so strident in the respect that if you closely followed these Badgers and you knew Bo and you watched Bo in action, Bo was, you know, hardly a gentleman always. He could be a crotchety, crotch guy, you know, and an angry, you know, so there was a little edge to Bo that maybe revealed itself here.
So I'll put the same question to you. How do you deal, being cognizant of the complete irrationality of fandom and the advancing of old age and the dawning of awareness about the corruption of the whole game? Yeah. How do you put all of that together in what you do professionally and just how you feel as a fan?
Yeah, first of all, I ask the questions around here, Dennis. But the second thing, I mean, it's something that I think about all the time because I do feel very strongly that the college system is utterly broken and it is a perversion of the economic model when you have a situation where literally billions are being made by the NCAA, by conferences, by universities themselves. Certainly coaches are making tens of millions of dollars
Pitino
these days.
$6 million.
Highest paid public servants at many, many state universities.
Yeah.
It's very hard to look at that system and feel good about the sort of, you know, esprit de corps that it presents. But there's just something unstoppable, especially this time of year, about it as a product. I mean, that you and so there's cognitive dissonance involved. I don't think there's anything shameful to admit that.
And that would say that in the long term, corruption still wins. It still reigns because it captures us on an emotional level that we seek to tune out all the bad stuff and focus on the things that gives us emotional satisfaction.
Sure. And there are voluminous examples of that in every walk of life, aren't there?
There are.
Dennis Berman is the financial editor of the Wall Street Journal, the Wall Street part of the Wall Street Journal. He's been our guest today on the Free For All. Dennis, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And best of luck with next year's Cardinal season.
Thanks.
You're listening to the Free For All. Bye-bye.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.